make a case for a unique cohort that is going to address one of the emphasis areas of neurobehavior and at least one of them, neurobehavior and metabolic diabetes, obesity, and asthma, pulmonary, and birth defects, that those would be the, that if you had a unique cohort, that it might be eligible.
Yeah.
I mean, CFAS would fit into several of these priority areas that they have addressed. I mean, from our control group as well as to the biological prenatal outcomes or prenatal effects that they're also looking for. So I think there's a lot that we could contribute. And I think they're asking for group letters if there are consortium already doing this or coordinating centers, that they get a letter from that consortium. And if people can look at that RFI and put together things they think they can do, then I can, I think, write a one-page type of letter saying what we have available and go from there.
So Ed, I accidentally turned the speaker off, but so even though we don't have a birth cohort, you think there's a place for us to fit?
Yeah, I don't see anything in here that precludes that at all.
But we do have a birth cohort.
Well, under neurodevelopment, for example, I mean, they have autism, ADHD. They don't mention alcohol at all, but cognition is in there. And so, you know, I think we're pretty good.
Yeah, no, it doesn't mention the alcohol in that context of those focus areas, but elsewhere in this, I believe it mentions environmental exposures of all types, including chemical and behavioral. Yeah, I'm seeing it right here, just above those core elements. Environmental exposures, e.g. physical, chemical, biological, psychosocial, etc. So it's really broad in that sense.
So, I mean, you know, just so people are aware of this, I didn't want it to fall off anyone's radar screen. Dale has certainly been sending this out and trying to get people to participate. I knew that Tina had sent in a letter, and other people should look at the RFI and see if they want to send their own letter in or whether or not you want to try to. They're due the 14th, so there's not a tremendous amount of time.
Couldn't we do both, send our own and...
I think an organizational approach is going to possibly carry more weight, I would think, in the eye of the reader. But other people's opinions, even at the individual level, can't hurt.
Yeah, see, in Tabak's letter, he says, I encourage organizations to submit a single response reflective of the views of that organization membership as a whole. But I don't think that would preclude us from submitting individual ones. So if people have things they think, I would be happy to try to do that. All right.
One question. Did you say the deadline for responses was August 14th?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And in the RFI, there is a link that will take you to the site that will collect that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So we need a few updates before we start in with our WebEx. But, Helen, how's that cross-query tool coming?
It's coming. I submitted it for beta testing, and I received positive responses from Tina's group, from data admins in Tina's group and Sarah's group. I didn't see any responses from Jeff, Sarah, or Leah yet. I don't know, maybe they didn't have time to test it properly yet. And I'm looking forward to hear any questions or comments regarding that. If you would like me, I can give a little bit more details on what was implemented for cross-query.
Well, let's see what we have left of time toward the end, because we have two WebEx programs today. And if we can remind me to come back to that if we have time. But I would encourage everybody who was interested in emailing me about this cross-query tool to please try it out so that we can see if it works and not delay its implementation any further than it's already been. You know, we are 1 year and 10 months away from a renewal, so we don't have a lot of time to get these collaborative projects out into the literature. Bill, your data access committee?
The data use agreement is done. The data access policy is done. The form is done. I think the only thing we need to do is set up an email address where people who are interested in contacting the data access committee have an address by which they can contact us. Other than that, I think that it's pretty much ready to go, and I think presently, as soon as we get the final document, the data use agreement, up, we can start making this this process available to external investigators.
All right. And then, have you developed a plan to let people know that this would be available?
So I don't have a communications plan on that. I don't know what that community would be, but I'm happy to draft something that could be sent around.
Well, I think the one place we should start off with is the FASD study group as one potential, and also RSA and ISBRA as the secondary sources of that, to let them know that those data will be available so that we can meet the NIH requirement for data sharing and go from there.
Okay.
Do we have models from other consortia of how they've advertised?
I don't. I could probably contact COGA and see what they do. But,
Is Bill Dunphy on the call? Bill, I know you were involved with FaceSpace.
Yeah, I am. I don't believe they actually did advertise it beyond posting a link on their website, but I can check with them and get back to you.
All right. Well, I think the FASD study group would be a good place to start, then RSA and ISBRA, and it could be as simple as we've now have our data available, a little bit about what CFAS is. We have our data available. If you're interested, here's the link. I mean, it doesn't have to be all that big and bold, and you know, if people want it, they'll find it.
Okay.
All right. The next, Claire, do you want to talk about this? Claire, I, and Kathy Mitchell were on the phone the other day and talking about NOFAS's efforts and how they've been a large help to the research community, and NOFAS kind of needs our help, and Claire's kind of leading this for CFAS and other research groups. So, Claire, do you want to kind of bring everybody up to date on this?
Well, I've been willy-nilly. I was asked by NOFAS, as was Ed, to see if we could brainstorm a little bit about finding ways to support NOFAS's efforts. And I know I have been a huge beneficiary of NOFAS's help over the years, and I know most of the rest of us have one way or another, sometimes because they support the activities of the affiliate groups with small grants, sometimes because of their work with Congress, sometimes because we can refer patients to them. I mean, they've just been a huge resource. And I have been given to understand that they are now finding themselves in a situation where they really need some more help from the rest of us in terms of development, as we all are familiar with that probably from our various works, our job and the university, et cetera. But NOFAS is finding itself in a situation where this is important for them now. And I guess they wanted me to bring this to your attention and to get some ideas from all of you about how they could, what help we could be. One of the ways we could do that is by supporting their annual dinner, which is in September, either by buying a table or buying a ticket or finding other people to do so. So I guess the idea here is, how can we sort of pay back a little bit to NOFAS for all they've done over the years, and how can we marshal the creativity and talent of CFAS and the study group and so on to for NOFAS?
You know, many of the CFAS investigators have been honored by NOFAS, and I was hoping that CFAS could perhaps sponsor a table. Now, the only way we can do that is if people make contributions to do that. And so I would urge anyone who would like to contribute, even if they're not going to the gala, if we have a table, the affiliate members who will attend who don't have the resources to pay for the ticket, NOFAS waives their fee, and we can help support it by paying that fee rather than have NOFAS simply waive it and lose that money. So
that's a great idea. And then it could be a CFAS table then.
We'd have a CFAS table. We could, if anyone has any information or things that they want to put a review paper out there or whatever, we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you would like to contribute, please let me know and how much, and then I can forward that on. Claire, do you want to handle it? So
I'll be happy to do that.
So
the other thing that people can contribute if they want to is items for the silent auction that will be held. So if you have something in particular you feel would be of interest to the community, that would be a great thing to contribute as well.
Yeah. For example, if you have miles on an airline you are never going to use, those miles expire, so you can contribute those. So just think about it and remember how important NOFAS has been to each of us individually and to the field as a group, and hopefully you can respond. Dan?
Ed, remind me when the gala is held and what the cost of a table has been.
Kathy?
Yes, I'm here. So thank you so much to both Ed and Claire, who have agreed to really help us out in reaching the FASD research community. So the gala this year is on September the 17th at the French Embassy. And tables, they kind of run different prices, and you get your benefactor, a trustee, so some of the big corporations will donate $10,000 for a table, for instance, and then there's a lot of other benefits that come with this. What we had talked about for CFAS was to maybe have one table, as Ed was saying, where people could donate. The tickets are $250 a piece, but you don't have to donate $250. So whatever you contribute would kind of go into the CFAS, kitty. And so that hopefully we would, get enough to buy a table maybe at $2,500 or maybe, I don't know what we'd be able to raise. And the other idea was, rather than having, flowers or centerpieces, that we would have little cards that we would create that would feature some of the CFAS researchers, and so your work and a little bit about what you've done, because this whole gala is focused on international research. So that's what we're really trying to roll out. I will tell you, this year we're honoring William Kennedy Smith, who actually agreed many years ago in New Mexico to pilot the NOFAS Medical School curriculum, and was instrumental in getting NOFAS Kennedy Foundation money to continue with that medical school program. And I do know that there'll be a couple tables of Kennedys there. I don't know who will be there, but and we've got some pretty good sponsors that will be there, and we've got a few congressional leaders that are definitely coming, and many that have signed on. So, you know, you never know until you get down to the wire with who will actually be there. But Lisa Murkowski will be honored. We're trying to get Patty Murray there. Tom Cole is being honored. So,
but I think it really, we really need to have the other element, and that is those of us who do research and work in the field also represented.
Yes. Absolutely. So, you're absolutely right, Claire.
Do what you can. Ask your friends to do what they can. And now I don't want to take up all the time doing these types of things. So if we can do the WebExes next so that we're sure we get through those, that would be great. And I don't know who's going first, Johan or Bill.
I don't care. I can go first.
Okay.
How do I do that?
Go ahead, Jan. Okay. Ken, do you have the link? Ken, do you have the link for the WebEx?
Do you see
my... I'm here with. I'm sitting in Dale's office, so I'm,
okay.
I'm watching his screen. That makes it the easiest way to do it.
Yeah. All righty. Jill, do you want to turn that over to Jan?
I did. So now under the Quick Start tab, you just want to hit Share Desktop.
Okay.
You see it?
Yeah, you got to make it a little bigger.
How's that?
Bigger still.
No, we got the two slides on. You're in presenter mode.
Oh.
Swap displays.
You had it.
So, yeah, I think there is, I have some mirroring displays going on that might be messing it up. Let me undo that. That work?
The little button on the top that says swap displays, try that.
How's that?
Yeah. And I meant okay. Deepak. And I meant Deepak rather than Bill. I just read the wrong line there.
Good.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to get you upset there. All right. Yeah, so I have a reasonable size. So, okay, we're ready.
Excellent. So I didn't plan this as a big data blitz, so I won't be showing you lots of lovely images of our zebrafish, but just kind of what we've done and where we're going. So these are the original aims, and aim one went swimmingly well, so sort of what we've done from this is Neil right there, he's going on to Harvard for a postdoc here in a few months, but this is his characterization that we did with Tatiana on PDGFRA and ethanol, showing that there's a very strong genetic interaction. A follow-up paper where we screened a set of about, I think it was 20 mutants that Mary lead authored, and we found five of those genes that interacted with alcohol, Bangle 2 being the one that we were most interested in. Because like PDGFRA, we see interactions in the heterozygotes, so you don't have to lose both copies, just having an attenuation of the signaling through this gene is enough to cause a profound interaction with alcohol. And those are the sorts of things that we're most interested in. Then also last year, Ben's first author paper where he characterized the actual tissue concentrations of alcohol in the zebrafish, because we actually have to put these guys in a fairly high concentration of alcohol, and it turns out that they exclude the vast majority of that from their tissue through a still unknown mechanism. But we really had to know how much was getting in there, and so Ben undertook the hard work to figure that out. And then a couple papers that have been now submitted. Ben has, these are both developmental biology characterizations of a couple signaling pathways, and one of these, FGF, is alcohol sensitive and causes phenotypes that we really didn't understand, and so we had to kind of delve into the mechanism of these molecules in development of the lower facial skeleton, and that's something that Ben just submitted to development this week, and then one where the same signaling molecule is involved in development of the skull base. That's Neil's publication. It's over a month ago, so we're hoping that we'll hear back positively pretty soon. From the screen, we had a few things that continue to be of interest. This Bangle 2, as I mentioned, we see haploinsufficiency for it when it's an alcohol, and so Alfira Siddig, who's not in this photo here, has been involved in looking at this, and she uncovered a recent publication that actually showed that Bangle 2 interacts with this gene here, PLK1. So there might be a little bit of a network in this group of genes that we identified here. So she's interested in that, as well as other mechanisms by which alcohol might interact with Bangle 2, such as Rajesh's favorite things, microRNA. She's taking a look at that. Still on this list, although it's kind of become a back burner project, nobody's really on it right now, but this is a cilia gene that we've obtained, and it does seem to have an enhanced phenotype in the presence of alcohol, and so that's something that hopefully it can get someone excited about and get that back running. And so then, as I presented at our last meeting, what we were really kind of trying to push forward now is this second aim, where we had done just a random mutagenesis to find ideally novel genes that regulate ethanol sensitivity. And so that's what we're still working pretty hard on. So this is what I showed you. We started with a bigger list than this. I think last time the list was larger, but we've had some attrition of our line. So we have these four mutants that either have no phenotype at all in the absence of ethanol or a fairly mild phenotype here. This is neurocranium being the skull base. And now suddenly we're very interested that these, this now has new phenotypes, and these guys that we really don't see any phenotypes in the absence of alcohol now have some pretty severe phenotypes. I don't know what I just did there. So we were working on genetic mapping of these, and so we were hung up on it at the last time I presented this, and I'd hoped that these would all have gene names next to them by now, but we remain only confident of this one here, and we have another likely candidate here. And so when I presented this before, we thought we were having some problem with our mapping program on our supercomputer. And so basically, just to give you some sense, I don't want to go through all the details, but we mutagenized the genome in the blue line, you cross that to yellow and you get hybrids, and then as you go another generation, all these blue and yellow bits recombine, and the only thing that remains 100% from this mutagenized background is the region of DNA that actually contains the mutation. And so then you can just sequence the entire genome and look for regions where any polymorphisms that go to homozygosity show up. And so when you plot it, it looks like this. So normally you'd be around 50% homozygous, and then you'd have a peak around the mutant where you're 100%. So we thought it was something wrong with our program that does this part on our supercomputer, but we've had our bioinformaticians go through the program that we were using that was made by another group called MegaMapper. And so it turns out the real problem is that this was written by a biologist instead of a bioinformatician. And that we've just found out there's this little thing called SNPF, which actually reads these things, these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And so it wasn't, the script wasn't written to deal with updates to this little program. And so now what we are having is our bioinformatics team here just write a new script. And this script is actually fairly complicated, which I think is why it wasn't identifying these things, where all we really need to know is the amount of homozygosity. So we're writing a new, simpler script. They think that once we come to a decision on what that exactly should be, it's less than 40 hours of work. So we're hoping that this will be started back up again here soon. So then other things that have happened, as I presented last time, we had a new R01 where we will continue the genetic screening that I did, and then expand that to take a look at neurons and behavior, and then take a look at two very specific pathways that might reduce ethanol-induced teratogenesis. This one will come back up again, and then this regulates protein folding, so misfolded proteins are recognized by this and refolded. And so with that, we've brought in some new lab members. So Johan Fernandez just started at the beginning of this month. He's coming from Dr. Gerlei's lab, and he's actually pioneered behavioral analysis of alcohol-exposed zebrafish. And so we're really excited to have him in the lab. We're getting things set up to where we can start doing some screening of our ethanol-treated mutants. I have a new grad student who's going to take on the forward, at least some of the forward genetic mutants, and we're hoping to get a diversity supplement to bring in Dr. Buckley here, who has expertise in neural development. So that'll really nicely round out our team of people with expertise in genetics, neural development, and behavior. So our goals before the next iteration of CFAS is obviously to finalize and verify this mapping. This AIM-2 dragging on so long has been really irritating. And so we want to just publish a description of the screen that's going to require that we've mapped everyone and at least verified nicely one of those. And then in the longer term, we'll have a deeper characterization of each mutant. And then the other goal is to really obtain preliminary results, as I talked about a little bit at our last meeting, because we want to, instead of looking for enhancers of ethanol teratogenesis, we really want to get at suppressors. And I think we have some ways to go about it. So I'll show this again. I talked about it in our last meeting. But we can find suppressors that are pathway specific. So once we have a gene that sensitizes to low ethanol concentrations, and this is Ben's work, what that low concentration is, we can now try to find suppressors that are pathway specific. But we could also take a look at stage specific suppressors by hitting them with a higher dose of ethanol, and we don't quite know exactly what that should be right now. But at specific stages, such as gastrulation, when these embryos are particularly sensitive. And this is what I showed last time as a way. So our forward genetic screens are laborious because it takes several generations to get the mutants, and so it would be ideal to have something that's very high throughput. And so we think we've engineered a genetic way to actually screen for phenotypes in the very first generation. And it requires taking two genes that are very close to one another on the chromosome, and so they don't rearrange from one another. And so if you put, and this is the actual genes we're thinking of, our PDGFRA mutant lies right next to another gene in the same pathway, CTGF, FGF, both growth factors. Put a mutated allele on one copy of the chromosome and a mutated allele this on the other copy, and so they balance each other out here. Mutants, you get two bad copies here, two bad copies there, you're going to have a dead fish. And then we know that if we add alcohol, this now makes this genotype sensitive to ethanol as well. And so now we can screen for fish that aren't sick following ethanol exposure in the very first generation. So obviously we need a little preliminary data for that, and I guess that's actually the next slide. But the other thing I just recently went to, I realized that we have a small molecule screening core here at UT Austin with about 70,000 compounds. And so we could similarly array our mutants or our, you know, either in a pathway-specific or a state-specific way to screen compounds that would suppress. And so we obviously want some proof of principle here, and so that's what we're going to be working on. We have a little bit of evidence for suppressors that we can actually get them from Neil's work. If you remember, this is that gene that he identified. We know the pathway that leads to the death of the cells that should make the palatal skeleton here. And so he found that if you actually knock down this gene here, you can restore the phenotype to suppress the ethanol teratogenicity. So we group that. So that's a gene, and then this is a molecule, L-leucine, that actually activates the pathway and also can suppress. So we have a little bit of evidence. Of course, we'd like to get more. And
Johan, excuse me, what concentration of leucine were you using to reverse that effect?
That's an excellent question. Was it... I have to say I'm not 100% sure. I want to say it was like 100 micromolar or something.
Okay.
But I don't know.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we let Deepak present his, and so I'll hold the questions. These are the two developmental projects that have come to a conclusion within CFAS, and Johan's turned his into an R01, and we're going to keep Johan group involved in CFAS because we think it may be a project that could move forward in the next iteration. And now Deepak's developmental project. Deepak, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, and then we can hold off questions till I'll make sure because we only have like 15 minutes left. So Deepak, if you can do this in 10, that'd be great.
Can you see my...
Nope.
No.
No.
Under Quick Start, you just want to go to Share Desktop.
So where do I find that under Quick Start? Okay.
All right. Now just make it larger.
So I bring that to you. Okay, quick.
Now, if you lost it again, Deepak, go to Quick Start, or Claire
yeah.
now has it.
I don't want it.
How'd you do that, Claire?
I don't know.
Did you see it?
I don't want it. How did I get it?
That was weird. I don't know
there
what happened.
There you go, Deepak. All right, just, there you are. You're on.
I'm on?
You're on.
All right, so what I'm going to do today, I think, you know, I already presented all my data in the last CFAS meeting. So today I'm just going to update, you know, some of the things which we're finishing up. So I'll show you those and also talk about a little bit of what we are going to do in future. So, you know, we had only one hypothesis to check whether or not this, you know, alcohol drinking during pregnancy really affects these couple of important genes, epigenetic modification of these genes, and whether these epigenetic modification persists in the fetus and could be used as a biomarker. To do that, you know, I have shown you all kinds of evidence that indeed they are present. You can find them in fetal alcohol offspring saliva. You can find them also in some of the blood. So here, we used basically a method which imply methylation-specific PCR, but since we are finishing up this paper and trying to submit this work in a good, high-ranking paper, we thought it would be important to do a little bit very specific methylation study. So what we did here, we did the fire sequencing, which really looked at the methylation of epigenetic islands. And by doing this fire sequencing, we find indeed the methylation we saw in methylation-specific PCR could be also found in this fire sequencing process. And where we find that there are two CpG islands in the POMC genes have a higher methylation, both in FAS as well as alcohol-exposed children saliva. We also received some samples from Tina, and started doing this, and I presented some of the data, but that study has been completed. We not only now find the changes of the POMC and PAR gene in saliva of offspring, but we also can detect them in the blood of pregnant women who have given birth to FAS children as well as alcohol exposed no FAS symptoms or any other characteristics of children who were given by that by pregnant women who drank alcohol. So here we saw that the POMC gene methylation changed by MSPCR as well as viral sequencing. So now we are very certain, and I think we are now have the solid data to really go forward for publication, showing that these methylation changes we are seeing is real and is not only and is persistent and is starts much earlier. Is not starts in the fetuses. It starts during pregnancy, and you can detect them in pregnant women. Another thing we are trying to do is to get all these methylation genes, trying to show them that methylation genes are really functional and they really affect the gene production as well as protein production. So we measure some of the protein relevant to these POMC genes as well as PAR genes. And some of the data I showed you before in the last meeting, but I completed those data because we didn't have all the samples. Now we have basically a large number of samples to do lots of statistics. And here you can see that the beta endorphin, which is a product of POMC genes, is really suppressed in male offspring as well as in female offspring. And an interesting part that they have a circadian rhythm of these genes, and the circadian rhythm is really changed, really get affected by respect of reduction of the beta endorphin genes, a beta endorphin level in the saliva. We also measure cortisol, which is another signature protein of POMC gene, and there we find all these changes happen in the afternoon, both male and female, and these changes basically is kind of reverses, is kind of increases the or completely shut down the circadian rhythmicity in these male and female FASD offspring. So what it shows now that we have all the data we need, and basically what we have found so far, that chronic alcohol consumption epigenetically modified PAR2 and POMC genes, and we also have evidence now that this suppression, this epigenetical modification suppresses the expression of these genes. leading to circadian abnormality, stress, hyper-responsiveness, anxiety-like behavior. Some of them, we don't have these in the fetal alcohol children or the mother with fetal alcohol, but some of the biological study we have done conducted using animals, and so I want to combine this animal study as well as this human study to make a very solid publication where we can really clearly show that this epigenetic modification has a biological significance. And also, I think so far the data, our data clearly shows that alcohol makes epigenetic mark on the SPARC2 and POMC genes, as well as it affects the stress axis, which transmits offspring. So I want to predict, but again, I will, after I write, I'll circulate all the papers and I'll discuss with everybody. Maybe I would like to propose that measuring their level in biological fluid of pregnant women as well as, you know, children could be potential identify as a biomarker or potentially identify the future health outcome. And we, last time I showed quite a bit of data, both in animal as well as human, choline supplementation can reverse some of this epigenetic mark and therefore may have a beneficial effect. But I'm keeping in touch with Jeff, and Jeff said that he's going to bring those kids who were getting treatment with the choline, and he mentioned that he will try to get this stress paradigm and some of the stress-related behavioral paradigm to look at to see whether or not these findings we found so far may have a clinical relevance. So I'm really excited about that. So basically what I want to show you now,
you got about 3 minutes left, though, Deepak, all right?
We actually didn't find the prior sequencing of part two, so which we still have some problem. We are trying to resolve this issue, and hopefully we'll get the result. Once it's finished, then we are going to write the paper for publication. And also, I am dealing with some of the collaborators and others trying to put out R1. And really, in this R01, I want to really look at some of the epigenetic signature mark on epigenome, both FS, non-FS children, by doing varieties of sophisticated epigenetic measurement. And then we're going to do also biological pathway analysis by chip sequencing and RNA sequencing. And then we're going to look at some of the epigenetic modifier to show whether or not there's any beneficial effect. This will be something which I want to put in for our future R1. So that's all I have.
All right. Thanks, Deepak, and good luck with that R01. And, this is really interesting. I think it opens up some new avenues in terms of circadian rhythms, sleep pathways, et cetera, as well as some markers that might be useful. So, and the choline data is interesting as well. It'll be interesting to see what you and Jeff come up with on that.
Thank you.
Any questions for either Johan or Deepak?
Well, I just wanted to go back to Johan's the leucine question. Besides the concentration, Johan, do you have any idea whether that is selective for that particular amino acid or what other similarly structured amino acids give a similar kind of effect?
Right. So I looked it up, and it's actually 50 millimolar, but that's in the solution. So we actually don't, again, like with the ethanol, we don't know how much is getting into the tissue. But apparently previous publications had used 100 millimolar to show effects, so we're at half of that. And so the other question, would other amino acids work? Right. We don't know. We haven't tested them. I mean, so mTOR functions as a nutrient sensor. So it, It's certainly possible, but we don't have any experimental data.
Okay.
All right. In the few remaining minutes, there's a few things I have to mention. This time for the conference call is not working out for some people, and so we have to change it. We tried to do it the first week of the month, and that didn't seem to work out. So Jill has sent out a new doodle poll. I believe she did it yesterday. And if you could get that back so we can try to make a time we can get everybody on the call. So please be as liberal as you possibly can and just say, you know, when you absolutely can't make it. And we'll try, because there's a lot of people to get coordinated. And this first Wednesday of the month isn't working out so well. So please look for that email from Jill, and we go from there. Jennifer needs any new news items that you may have for our website, so if you could please get those into her. We will talk about project updates on the next call, and we'll do that. And I will be emailing you. I've been asked to answer some questions for a lay audience, and some of them are outside of my area, so I'm going to try to utilize CFAS resources and get really short one or two, three sentence answers to some of these questions that I don't know anything about. So if you get an email from me, you'll know what it's about. Dale and Bill, anything from NIAAA that we need to know?
I've said my piece already. I don't know about Bill or Ken.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Warren, the czar?
Expect the shutdown on October 1.
You think so, huh?
Yeah. Right. The Planned Parenthood issue is really, really nasty.
Mm. Well, just don't be out of the country on October 1, then.
No, I'm going to be out of the country on October 1.
I know.
I'm going to be home.
Best place to be.
Oh, all right.
Check something real quick.
Yep.
Hi, on the top of your WebEx, you can see the CIFSC concept proposals that were accepted this month. That number was zero, and manuscript submissions was zero, but there was a post-acceptance form. So if you click to the right, you can see the kind of information that Dr. Chambers answered in order to get that out NOFAS and NIAAA, and then you can actually see on the July CIFSC publication tab the name of the publication that went out in July. So keep answering those forms.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, it's 1 year, 10 months, and so you really have to start grinding down, and so we can show progress, and hopefully CFAS will continue its existence. All right. So is there any other business? Dan?
I have nothing more at this point.
Okay. All righty. Well, we're done 2 minutes early, so I'm sorry I cut you off a little early, Deepak. Any other issues that need to be raised? Again, I would have people look at the Google Docs, see where they are relative to their goal. Some projects are doing very well. Others are still a little behind on their goals, and I urge you to get those up because it's all going to come down when, if and when an RFA goes out for the continuation of CFAS, and if we are lucky enough to get a reverse site visit, I am sure we're going to get questions about our aims and what aims we've met and what deliverables we've produced. So I am going to be asking the Science Advisory Board, in fact, to look at each proposal and the specific aims and then see what they can find on PubMed or in the publications from progress reports that go toward meeting those aims. And we're going to have to use that type of information when we consider projects to move forward on in CFAS. So if you have things out there, you got to let us know about them. All right. righty. I am done. If Michael and Elizabeth can stay on the call, I would appreciate it. I got we got one little item to discuss, and then we will all do this again next month, hopefully at a different time, so that Sarah Jo can start joining us, all right? And other people as well. Thanks, and have a great month.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye.